Welcome, welcome. I'm Bill Tinker, and you're listening to Dialysis Talk on Blog Talk Radio, where we discuss the healthcare issues of dialysis patients along with other present-day healthcare issues. Dialysis Talk is brought to you by Dialysis Advocates. The information and opinions expressed by our guests are theirs alone and do not reflect the opinion of Dialysis Talk or Dialysis Advocates. We have a great show lined up for you tonight, and with that, let's turn it over to tonight's host.
Hi, this is Arlene Mullen Tinker. Carol is in the hospital and is having surgery on Monday and asked for all of us to say a prayer for her. So she should be back in a couple of weeks. Our guest tonight, I have heard about her for years and is well respected in this industry, Dori Chattel. Welcome, Dori.
Thank you, Arlene. It's nice to be here.
And if you can tell us a little bit about yourself, and then, you know, in other words, you know, you don't have kidney problems, but you've worked in this field for 25 years. How did that happen?
That is a kind of a long story, actually.
We have time.
I know. That's nice to have time. When I was about 8 years old, My family went. We used to go to the art fairs in Chicago. We used to go to the Gold Coast Art Fair and I don't even remember the other art fair. But I remember we wandered into an old bookstore and there was a book that I really wanted called The Doctors Who Conquered Yellow Fever. And my mom would not buy me this book. And believe it or not, I think that not getting this book actually triggered a whole lifelong interest in medicine and chronic disease and epidemiology. Sometimes what you don't get is maybe more important than what you do get. But anyway, when I went to college, I would have gotten a master's in public health degree, but they didn't have one at Madison. This was University of Wisconsin. You know, this was, 1980 or so. They didn't have a master's in public health program. They have one now, but they didn't have one back then. So I got an undergrad degree in psychology and history of medicine, and I went to graduate school in child and family studies, and I did desktop publishing for the student family housing where we lived. You know, I had a baby, and I was at home. My husband was in grad school. And with this desktop publishing, ended up, there was a little newspaper ad looking for somebody who did desktop publishing, and I answered the ad, and I ended up working for Edie Oberle, and Edie was the home hemodialysis partner for her husband, Terry. Terry was on dialysis for 43 years before he finally stopped. Home hemodialysis, mostly three times a week. 43 years. He finally withdrew from dialysis, I think it was the fall before last, and actually, he outlived Edie, and I don't think any of us would have ever imagined that. She was very full of life. But he lived a very long, very happy life. He stayed a doctor. He was a renal pathologist, and he worked, I think, to the end. So I knew from Terry that it was possible for people to live a long time and have a good life on dialysis, but then you looked at the statistics, and, you know, patients in the U.S. just do so poorly compared to other countries and compared to these really outstanding people I met, like Terry and like my friend Nancy Space, whose kidneys failed in 1966, and now she's retired and she's a grandma. And there was this gap. There was this gap between it's possible for people to do really well, but so few of them do, that to me that was just so compelling that I've just stuck around all this time.
Wow. I'm a strong advocate for home hemo, strong advocate, and transplants, you know. What has been your, I'm curious, what's been your most important source of information as you developed educational materials?
You know, everything that we develop, it's always based on the published research papers. But what's really the most important and what drives everything we do is patients, hearing from, and I don't even like that word patient. I'm actually not a big fan. I prefer consumers or dialyzers or almost anything except patients, because I think the last thing that you really want to be when you have a chronic disease, which something like half of Americans do, is patient. You don't want to be patient. You want to take matters into your own hands. You want to learn. You want to feel as well as you can every day, which is kind of your goal when you have a chronic disease, because we can't treat a chronic, you know, we can't heal a chronic disease. We can't cure it. So having as many good days as possible and as few bad days as possible is the goal. And we can do that, but it takes a lot of effort. And so I listen. I've listened to patients every single day since 1997. I mean, I got online. My friend Dale Esther started and he was a transplant patient.
Oh,
he started
yes,
an email. Do you remember
yes.
Dale?
Yes, right. I do. He did remarkable things.
Yes, he did. Well, he started an email listserv really early. I mean, I got online in 1995. I found this listserv in 1997 and joined it. And it ran for years until he passed away from an unfortunate he had too high of a concentration of one of his transplant meds, and it stopped his heart. It was very sad. But Dale ran this listserv that was just the most amazing place for people to learn, because he knew so much. He had learned everything the hard way. You know, his kidneys failed emergently. He wasn't expecting it, and he started dialysis, you know, in the ER, and he learned everything about his treatment. And then he got the transplant. He learned everything about the transplant. So he was an amazing consumer resource for other patients or other dialyzers. Exactly. So that listserv, I saved messages. I still have them. I have something like 16,000 messages that I saved from that email listserv. And now, of course, everybody's kind of moved over to Facebook and message boards and other places. But
right.
Being in this sort of constant stream of information from people who were going through this, and being able to see, what are the questions that come up over and over and over? What do people not know? Where is there missing information? That's what we try to do, is fill the gaps and create a sort of a structure of information so that it's easier for people to kind of leap in from wherever they start.
My question also is, where do people, we'll put it on our Facebook and on our website, how do they get in touch with you and read some of what you are doing? Because you're just as impactful, Dori.
Oh, thank you. We have all kinds of websites. So mostly we distribute materials through the Internet, and we started that in about 2001 when it got to be really, really expensive to be mailing things out. So we still mail some things out, but not too many. We have 8 websites altogether for the Medical Education Institute, and that's the nonprofit that I run. And of those, 4 of them are what we would call consumer-facing. So Kidney School, it's kidneyschool.org, which has...
I've heard of that.
16 modules
yes.
of easy-to-read information about every topic, from sexuality, fertility, anemia, your lab tests. You said you were telling me before the show that you were a lab technician. Well, you might want to check that for us and make sure it's still
yeah,
up to date.
You know?
nutrition, alternative therapies. I mean, just about any topic that you can think of, we have a module of Kidney School, and these are all written, like everything we do, they're written at the 6th grade reading level, and that's on purpose. Not because we think that anybody is stupid, but because we realize that they're scared and they're overwhelmed and that this is a topic that they may not know. And that even if you've got a PhD, you still may want to start with something that's just easy to grasp. So we always write at this level that makes it easy for people to understand. And we use pictures and we use stories and we use whatever we can to try to help people get this, because they need to get it. The Kidney School, it's sort of a threefer. It's you can go through the modules online live, and they're tailored and interactive. So as you go through, you can answer questions, and you can sort of save things for yourself, and it'll create a personal action plan at the end. Or you
wow.
can listen to Kidney School. You can listen to audio tapes of it. So my friend Nancy Spaeth, she read half of those modules out loud. And my friend Brian O'Moore, do you know Brian?
The name sounds very familiar.
Yeah, he worked for the network years ago. He's had a kidney pancreas transplant and was a member of the Life Options Council, as was Nancy. But the two of them are, you know, actual consumers, and they read these modules out loud, and they introduce themselves, and they say, you know, I've done really well, and you can too, which is an important message. And then Kidney School is also downloadable PDFs, and those are in English and Spanish. So that's one of our patient sites. Home Dialysis Central, you might have run across that one. That's one of our patient sites. Life Options is a patient site, and I'm sure I'll remember the other one soon.
Well,
I'm sure I said there were four, and I can only think of three.
Let's talk and think about it. One thing I've noticed is the positive attitude, and how important do you think that really is for a patient? I disagree. I agree with you that a patient is a support word. My husband, who died of cancer, he says cancer's a word, not a not my life. It's just a word.
Right. It is so important to stay positive. Depression is a killer. Optimists live longer. If you look at research outside of kidney disease, because this doesn't get studied very much in kidney disease. I found one study of hope in kidney disease, and really that's what we're talking about, right? When we're talking about staying positive, we're talking about hope. We're talking about having hope that you can pull a good life out of what's happening. You know, and you can. It can be done, but you have to believe it can be done, and you have to work for it. You have, you know, it doesn't happen by accident. People don't live for 30 or 40 years after the kidneys fail by mistake. You know, there's some effort that's going in there. But
there's some effort. I missed that. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean that to live a really long time with a chronic disease, you have to learn what's going on. You have to know yourself, and you have to know your treatment, and you have to ask questions, and you have to speak up when something is not right. So part of your job is to learn all that you can, and part of your job is to take action on your own behalf. But before you can do any of those things, you've got to have hope that you can have a life, and that's where the positive comes in. So we did some of the very earliest research, I think, directly with dialysis consumers, because there was a whole lot of research back when I started, I started in 1989, but even in the early 90s, the research was professionals talking about patients, and there wasn't a lot of people talking directly to the patients, so that was what we did, and we did, even in somewhere in the mid-90s, we did a series of telephone interview studies where people would call us up and they would ask for our materials, and we would collect their information, we'd put it in a database, and we would call up some of them and we would interview them. And I still remember some. I mean, I did some of those interviews myself. I still remember a woman who found out when she was in college that her kidneys were failing, and she broke off her engagement with her fiance, and she went to a doctor and had her tubes tied because she thought her life was over. Her life wasn't over. I mean, I know people who've had kidney transplants and had babies. And those stories really stick with you. So what we learned in those first studies that we did, talking directly to these people for maybe the first time, is that there were a number of things that they had in common, things that we would hear again and again and again. We would ask the same question different ways. We would say, what messages helped you? Or we would say, what would you tell somebody else who had a kidney problem? Or what do you wish someone had told you? And the same things would come up over and over. And one of those things was, you have to have a positive attitude.
Oh, yeah.
So
how do
we share that? You have to look for sources of hope. You have to look for people who are doing well. You know, they have to be your beacons. So I'm excited that there are some mentorship programs that are really sort of rising up very recently. I'm on the board of one called ReMend that's out of the San Diego area that is very exciting, and there are other ones in various other parts of the country. And that's an opportunity for people who are new to this, people who are scared, to see that you can have a life and you can have hope and you can move forward. And, you know, don't give up. So being sources of hope is really important. I think that professionals can do that for patients. If there aren't maybe other mentors or buddies that happen to be around nearby, you can still share stories of people who do well. So that's the sort of thing that we need to do, because if you've never heard of this before, and maybe all you've ever seen of kidney failure is, you know, something dire on television, you might not know that there's hope, and you need to know.
Wow, it sounds like you are really into the thick of it, research, and that's amazing. That is really amazing, and that is something that the patients have needed all along, is education, the understanding, and sometimes that is lacking. What about your educational materials? Is that what...
Those are probably my very, very favorite thing to do, because I just love trying to make some of this complex information clear for people who are scared and who need it. We always, when we design materials, we start with hope, always. No matter what else the message is, I don't care if we're talking about vascular access or we're talking about your treatment options or whatever it is we're talking about, we always start with hope, because if people don't have hope, they can't hear anything else we say. At least I don't think they can. I can't prove that. I was starting to tell you about this one study about hope. This is it was in the UK. It was a very small study. It was like 112 people, but by I think Billington. And the interesting thing to me was that this study found exactly what you might think that a study about hope would find, which is that people who were more hopeful were less depressed, and they were less anxious, and they didn't feel as burdened by their disease. And what was almost, and those are all really important things, but what was almost even more important than that is that they had better mental functioning. And this is measured by a survey. It happens to be a survey that Medicare requires that kidney patients, at least people on dialysis, take each year in the U.S. And the results of that, having better mental functioning actually predicts that you would be less likely to be in the hospital and more likely to live. So that basically says hope is a life and death prospect. It's that important.
That, and I remember, working in a hospital that a lot of times people mentally give up, and they're the ones.
Exactly. They're hopeless.
We are the ones, you know. Yeah, and it's like the ones we thought were at the end weren't. And
right.
The ones who would survive just died. And it always amazed, I think, everyone that worked that how that was. And I know that with patients, I remember a patient came into the lab one day and she had stage 4 breast cancer. And I said, how long ago did you have it? She goes, 10 years. I'm like, you're kidding. Absolutely,
wow.
You've got to be kidding. And she goes, I made up my mind that, and I mean stage 4. I could read her charts. Stage 4, 10 years, which, you know, she's just was doing wonderful. But she said no other woman was going to move into her house and take care of her children.
Wow, that's motivation.
And that seemed to the catalyst. So that is so true what you're saying, you know. And you wrote a book with Dr. Agar, and
right,
I think it's called
right.
Yeah, and it's Help, I Need Dialysis. I've heard of that book. I've never read it. I've heard of it. Why did you call
it
that?
You should read it.
I will, you know, in my spare time, Dori.
Exactly. Well, let me back up a little bit and tell you a little bit more about how we develop materials, and then I'll tell you a little bit about the book.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll want to read it in your spare time. Because, you know, who doesn't? So, all right, so we start with hope, but the job of somebody who has a chronic disease, any chronic disease, not necessarily just this one, any chronic disease, you have a job. It is not necessarily a job that you signed up for. It's not necessarily a job that you want. It may take time out of your day or your week that you really can't spare because, you know, you have this life. but you have this job, and the job is self-management. The job is to take care of yourself, to know yourself, to notice your symptoms and tell them to your care team, to know what your treatments are and why you're doing them. So, you know, if you've got 10 different pills to take, you know, you need to know what each of those 10 is for and what they do and why you need to take them and what happens if you don't. You know, you need to know all of this stuff, and you need to manage, because our whole healthcare system is set up for acute illness. You know, it's set up for things like separating Siamese twins or conjoined twins, I guess I should say, and, you know, or Ebola or, you know, something critical like that. But the reality is 75% of all of the healthcare dollars in this country and 75% of all the deaths are related to chronic disease. So chronic disease is really where sort of the low-hanging fruit is, and I feel like we do not maximize people's ability to take care of themselves. We don't teach them how. It's not part of the system. That's really part of the reason that we're so passionate about home therapies, because there is no other place in the kidney failure world where people actually are purposely trained in how to take care of themselves. You know, usually you go into a center and you sit in the chair, and the clinics are now required to educate you. That's as of 2008. You know, the conditions for coverage of 2008 changed things. But, you know, I remember a focus group where a fellow said, I've been on dialysis for 6 years and I don't know any more than when I started. Yeah. That's not self-managing. Well, you know what? It is self-managing. The problem is you can self-manage poorly, or you can self-manage well. And when you need to follow a restricted diet and limit your fluids and take a bunch of medications the right way and show up for your treatments and stay the whole time and get a certain kind of an access, you have this giant complex role that nobody really teaches you. They all know it themselves and just sort of assume that you know it too. And you don't know it, and you need to know it. And knowing it can save your own life. So the book and everything else that we do, we're trying to put forth this job of self-management, help people even see that they have this job. Because I also remember a fellow from a focus group that we did who, you know, we asked the question, how did you learn what you needed to know about your kidney disease? You know, did you talk to your doctor? Did you go to the library? You know, what were your sources? And he looked right at the moderator and he said, I didn't know I was supposed to be looking for information about my disease. If somebody would have told me to look for information, I would have done that. And I thought, bingo. Some of us just know this, probably those of us who go to college. When you go to college, then you get this, you have this knowledge approach to life. You know, you want to buy a car, you go to Consumer Reports, or you go online and you research cars, or you want to buy a new refrigerator, you know, you're going to look up refrigerators and you're going to do this homework. But if that's not your orientation to the world, if you don't think of that and nobody explicitly tells you, then you might not know it's your job, even though you'd be willing to do it if you did know. So we tell people, this is your job. You have a job. Maybe you didn't want the job. Your job is to self-manage. This is what that means. You know, notice and report your symptoms, take your medicines, all of these things that people need to do. And then everything that we develop, we ground in motivational theory. So it's something called self-determination theory, and this is a theory that holds that all of us humans, from infancy on, with or without disease, you know, if we smoke or whatever, we all have three critical psychological needs that have to be met for us to grow and thrive and be joyful, you know, growing people in our lives. And those are competence. We have to feel like we are able to do what we set out to do. Autonomy. We need to feel like we are making active choices, like we're in charge. Life isn't just happening to us. We are making things happen for ourselves. And relatedness. We need to feel like we're connected to others. So we build all of those things into all of our materials. And I already mentioned that we make them easy to read. So that's kind of where we started with the book. The thing about the book, we called it Help, I Need Dialysis, because from what I've seen from all of these hundreds, and it was hundreds of people in on the email listserv in 1997, it's thousands of people every day now that I hear from through Facebook and, you know, all sorts of different ways. thousands of them every single day. I know how scared they are. I hear how scared they are. When they are starting, they are terrified. So we called it Help, I Need Dialysis, because that's how they feel. And we actually ran the draft of the book past a panel of about a dozen people, and the cover, everything. And we incorporated all of their comments before we put the book out there to make sure that it really did resonate. And it did. The people are actually so scared that every year in the U.S., 40 to 50% of people who start dialysis do so emergently. So they may have 3 months or less notice that their kidneys have basically failed. That says
Wow. We
are not doing a good enough job. You know, we're not connecting the dots. We're not tracking people. And what's really scary is that most of those people have diabetes. They know their kidneys are failing, but they're terrified and nobody's given them any hope.
Well, do you think sometimes it might be depression? I mean,
depression is hopelessness,
I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah,
I think depression
is
the flip side of hope. I mean, I don't know if that's clinically true. You know, I haven't looked at the studies. But we wrote the book because so few people really understand their options, and what they really don't get is how each of the different treatments, each of the different dialysis treatments. Now, our intention is to also do a book about transplant. So it's not that we left it out. It's that it actually deserves its own book. There's so much. You can't just sort of give it a chapter in a book about dialysis and think that you've done it justice. But there wasn't a good overview for consumers of all of the different types of dialysis and what they might mean for things like, what are you going to be able to eat? How much will you be able to drink? What kind of symptoms might you have? Are you going to be able to sleep pretty well at night? Will you be able to work? How about travel? Can you travel with this treatment or that treatment? What if you want a baby? What if you want to have a sex life with your partner? You know, nobody tells people about these things, and instead, I feel like they make the choice of treatment out of fear. Oh, my God, this is terrifying. I want somebody to take care of me. And they don't know what they're giving up, and they're giving up a lot. That's why.
Yeah, they are. They totally are.
Right.
I totally agree with that. Totally. Because it's got to be frightening. There's a lot of different ways to do dialysis. How should people choose which is best for them?
We built a tool to actually help people. The book took us 3 years to write. And it's got stories, and it's got references, and it's indexed, and we won a National Health Information Award for it in the gold category, which we were excited about. But the book has all of the information. It has all of the background, but it still doesn't quite get to the point of helping you choose and figure out, well, what would fit my life. You can kind of read between the lines, and you might be able to figure it out, but what Dr. Agar really wanted us to do was to build a tool that would make it would be interactive, and it would sort of do this mapping so that people could use an app, sort of. It's not an app yet. Right now it's still a website, but we have plans to make it an app. So they could use this app, and it would contain the information from the book, but in an interactive way that would make it easier to see what you would want. So the book took 3 years, and the decision aid took another 3 years almost. We kind of started the decision aid when we were kind of almost done with the book. And it's that's actually our fourth website, the one that I couldn't remember before. It's decision aid.
Good going, Dory.
Right? It's www.mydialysischoice.org. And what it does is, instead of doing what we've done for years and years and years in this community, and I have done it myself, I've done it a lot of times. I totally get why we start here. But normally what we do when somebody finds out, you know, that they need to choose an option is we say, well, there's two ways to do dialysis. there's peritoneal dialysis, and we'll put a tube in your belly, and you learn how to fill that. Nurse will teach you, and you'll fill that up with sterile fluid, and that'll dwell for a while, and then you'll drain it back out, and it's painless, and there's no needles, and you can do this at night, every night with a cycler, and, you know, and then there's hemodialysis, and we'll put needles in your arm, and we'll take blood out of your body, and we'll pass it through a machine, and there's a filter and a blood pump, and it pushes your, you know, and we give them, we snow them with all of these details about how the treatments work. But we don't tell them why they might want one or the other. And the problem is that as soon as you say, tube in the belly, needles in the arm,
right.
What did you think when I said those?
Peritoneal.
Right, but I mean, don't you think, oh my God, I don't want any of those things?
Well, definitely, yes. I mean, it's...
Right.
It's,
I don't think
there's enough education. I know when I started, we had educational nurses, so we never had a patient just start. They were thoroughly educated before they got on the machine.
Mm-hmm.
But we also educated as we went along. It's frightening. It has to be.
Oh, absolutely. It's terrifying. But the problem is that if we start with the how and not the why,
right.
And we leave people scared and hopeless, then what they want is for people to take care of them. What they really want is for this to not be happening to them. And nobody could blame them. What you really want, I mean, you hear a lot about denial. Have you heard denial mentioned?
Oh, yes, all the time.
Right, well,
all the time.
This is where it comes from. It comes from, I am terrified that life as I know it will be over and not worth living, and I'm just not going to go there. This is not happening. La, 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 I can't hear you. And that's why they
well,
end up in the emergency room.
Right, and I have calls all the time that patients, you know, I just want to give up. I'm, you know, they just go into that dark hole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's got to be. But also, I know that there's a lot of patients have expressed they would love to have home hemo, but it's not given to everybody. And I think there's a new machine that from
Outset.
I'm drawing a blank.
Outset, the newest one is that's coming out is by Outset Medical.
Right,
it's not
but
out
there's
yet,
one
quite yet.
Oh,
oh,
okay,
you're
maybe
next
it's just,
stage.
Next stage, right.
That yeah,
you
that,
could
that
have
one's
great
out. That one came out in 2004 or 5, I think.
Well, it had to go to FDA because they don't need
it
a
did.
Caregiver with this new one.
No.
From my understanding, that's why they had to go through the FDA trials. But I think it was cleared as of January to where you can do it at home. No?
Not quite. It you can do short daily hemodialysis at home with a partner with the next stage machine since about 2005. In December of last year, what finally came through the FDA was the approval to be able to use that machine to do nocturnal home treatments, still
correct.
With a partner. I really think we need to get on that partner issue. The U.S. is the only country that requires every home hemo patient or most of them to have a partner. Other countries, they don't require that. You know, in fact, in some other countries, like I think it's Denmark, they not only don't require one, they will not train one. If you want to do home hemo, you have to prove that you can do it yourself and not rely on a partner. So what we tend to do in the U.S. is we tend to just move the in-center unit home. So we... You know, if you came in with, you know, a sister or a son or, you know, whoever who said, oh, I'm going to be Arlene's partner, then they would train that person to be the technician and you would, well, you don't really need training, right? Because you're just the consumer. So you sit in the chair and stick out your arm and the other person does all the work and gets all the burden and then they fail and people drop off of home hemo in far too high of numbers. And that doesn't need to happen. That's a training error. You know that,
and why is that? Why is that? They
well,
drop.
Because the person who does the treatment should own the treatment. So, you know, to the extent, that's the fundamental problem is if you burden somebody else with your treatment and you make them put in the needles, which is especially scary, you're asking for failure. You know, some people can pull that off. Most people need to be as involved in their care as they can be. Not everybody can be, you know, can do their whole treatment. Some people can't do any of their treatment. But when they can, when they're able-bodied and they're bright and they're, you know, they could do it, and instead the center trains the partner to do it and doesn't, you know, really rely on them to do it, I absolutely, passionately believe that that's a huge mistake.
Oh, okay. And what's your source of information you've developed?
Let's go back to the decision aid.
Okay.
So the decision aid, it doesn't start in that place of here are your options. It starts in a totally different place, which is what matters to you. What are your values? So we brainstorm based on all these thousands of patients that we've been in contact with, thousands and thousands. Actually, Beth Witten, who's a renal social worker who's worked with me since 1992, and John Agar and I all built this decision aid based on the book. And the three of us together have, I think, 100 years of nephrology experience. So
oh, my goodness.
We've been doing this a while. So we, you know, based on all of these patients that all of us have contacted, you know, with have had contact with all over the years, we brainstormed. We came up with, I think, 22 values. We ended up adding two more, so there are 24 values now. And they're in categories. So there's lifestyle values like I need to be able to work or go to school. I need to be able to travel. I want to be able to eat and drink what I like. I love to swim. I've got pets. You know, I want to feel well from one day to the next. I'm worried about how much this will cost. Things like that. There are health values like, you know, I want to sleep as well as I can. I want the best chance for a transplant. I want to protect my heart and my bones and my joints, and I don't want to be in the hospital, and I want to live as long as I can. And then there are partner and family values. So things like, you know, I might want to have a baby, or I take care of a child or a disabled or elderly person. You know, I'm responsible for somebody else. How can I do a treatment that will let me keep doing that? I don't have a care partner to help me is one of them. I want to spend as much time as I can with my family. So you would go through these, pick the values that matter the most to you, and depending on the setting, you know, if you're doing this in a clinic or in a doctor's office, you might just pick three. But if you're doing it at home, you can pick every darn value if you want. Each one is going to take you 5 or 10 minutes. There's 24 of them. So if that was, you know, 10 minutes, this might be 2 hours. How much is the rest of your life worth to you? You know, it might be worth 2 hours to go through this and really see how each of these would work. So for each value that you pick, let's say I need to be able to work or go to school, there's a couple of sentence description of, you know, how it works, just something really positive. So this says, you can work or go to school on dialysis if you choose a work-friendly option. You know, work-friendly treatments fit your schedule. They give you more energy and mental focus, and they help you stay out of the hospital so you miss less work. And then there's four different boxes. There's one for peritoneal dialysis. There's one for standard hemo. There's one for daily hemo. And there's one for, it's still called extended hemo on here, but we're changing it to nocturnal because the FDA finally approved that next stage machine for nocturnal, so we don't have to say extended anymore. So there's these four boxes, and you can read, there's sort of the pros and cons for each treatment for that specific value. And then you can rate them with stars. So you can maybe look at peritoneal dialysis and work, and it says you can do PD with a cycler at night while you sleep. You may be able to do PD at work. You can take it with you on trips. You know, and I might look at that and I say, you know, that looks pretty good. I might give that 4 stars. You know, I have a job I really like. I want to keep my job. Maybe, you know, this looks like it would fit my job. You know, so you can rate each of these. And then at the end, when you're done looking at all your values, you get a summary that will tell you which values you picked and how you rated them. And then you can look at this yourself. We did not cook any numbers. We didn't do any funky calculations. It's all completely transparent. But if a doctor gets that, we are hopeful that it will change the conversation. You know, that instead of just maybe turfing patients to the nurse and saying, oh, well, okay, you go to the nurse and be educated, the doctor might say, oh, well, you know, it looks like working is really important to you. How can we keep you working?
Yeah, that would be really nice.
Yeah.
That would be really nice. It's getting your life, having your life back. And also, it cuts down. I think I've known quite a few patients on home hemo. To me, my own personal opinion is it's the Cadillac for a lot of patients. And not everybody's going to choose that, but that's
right.
What I would choose if it
what
were
I would
me.
Choose
but
too.
That's just me.
Yep.
Wow, I'm just really impressed. I would like to say, you know, if you could give me those links, I'd put them on our news portion so patients can click on or go to your site. I didn't realize it was this comprehensive, Dori, that you've done. I know that your name stands out in the industry, but I am really in awe. What a wonderful thing to do, and not even, you know, be a patient.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I would be very happy to give you those links. And you know, it's funny, my step grandfather actually was on dialysis in 1968. That is
wow.
What his kidneys failed. This was my grandma's second husband, so he was not a blood relative. But I didn't find out until I had already worked in this field for years that's what he died of. I mean, I knew that he had passed away, but I never knew
mm-hmm.
what from. It was such a shock.
It's funny how life does a full circle sometimes, you know?
Right?
Yeah, no.
It was,
yeah. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. I am just enjoying this. I am going to find time to read that book.
Good.
You know, I am.
Hello,
and then
your
I'll
friend.
Email you. Cause, yeah, I will find the time. And so your sources of educational is from just what you were saying, correct?
Right, right.
Okay, and if you change one thing about the ways with kidney pain, that would be what you were saying also, what you would change. If you had a magic wand, what would you change?
Oh, I would love to have a magic wand. Wouldn't you love to have a magic wand?
I probably hit somebody with it. Just kidding.
Well,
yes,
you don't
I
need a magic wand. You can just use a baseball bat.
So true.
Magic
so
wands
true.
Are just, yes, they're a little more finesse with a magic wand. If I could take a magic wand and just change the way that Americans with kidney failure are taken care of, I probably would do three different things. I'm trying to figure out how to say this really, really tactfully. I would change some of the things that Medicare looks at so that they shift that focus away from adequacy based on urea clearance, because we all know that urea is not really very hard to get out of the blood. And other countries like Australia, they don't even look at KTRV. It's just not even part of the equation. Rather than look at clearance of a tiny little molecule that doesn't really even matter, at the very least, we could be looking at fluid, because that is so critical. I mean, on a day-to-day basis, and I've told this to a lot of patients, probably 99% of how you feel on dialysis is about how the water is removed from your blood. You know, because most of the water in your body, it's not in your blood. It's inside of your cells, and it's in between your cells, and it's not in your blood. So if you come on 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, or I think, I'm not kidding, I heard as much as 12 liters over, I just about fell over, but it happens. You know, if you come in that fluid overloaded and you try to pull it out of your blood, it's not there. And so what happens is people crash. And when they crash, when their blood pressure drops and they crash, that causes myocardial stunning. It actually stuns the heart muscle. And over time, that causes permanent damage. It causes fibrosis. It causes heart failure. It causes sudden cardiac death. That is the number one cause of death on dialysis, and it is 100% preventable. If we would turn down the temperature of the dialysate, that's actually my blog post this week. If you do, I don't know if you go on Home Dialysis Central and you look at our blog, we have a Kidney Views blog. That's the topic this week of my blog is the talk that Chris McIntyre did at the annual dialysis conference. I called it Hearts in the Crossfire. But we could prevent that just by turning down the temperature of the dialysate half a degree centigrade below core body temperature. And that will avoid organ stunning. And it's actually not just the heart that gets stunned. It's also the kidneys. That's why, have you heard for years that standard in-center hemo kills remaining, you know, residual kidney function faster than any other option?
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Well, this is the mechanism for it. The kidneys get stunned. They there's so much blood going through the access and going through the machine that when blood pressure crashes, the organs don't get enough. The brain doesn't get enough. There's actually damage to the white matter in the brain.
What
the heart doesn't get
line?
Enough.
A PICC line.
I don't know how that would interact with any of that. I know that PICC lines are really frowned upon in vessels that are going to be used for access because they can cause stenosis. So you can really ruin the vessels by putting in a PICC line. But this is a different issue. This is about blood
pressure
dropping.
I've got a PICC line. I'm sorry, you know, I'm trying. I had a brain thing. The line to tell you, I thought it was called a PICC line.
Oh, a crit line.
Crit line. Yeah, I'm sitting there thinking, I'm back
line.
In the hospital.
Right. No, a crit line is technology that tells you how much water you're taking out. I think that's a great idea, and I believe that the Fresenius dialysis machines have that capability built in, where they can tell how much water they're taking off so that they don't hopefully stun people. But, you know, one thing that they could do today for free is they could turn that temperature to half a degree centigrade below core body temperature, you know, and there's all sorts of papers about this. I cited them in the blog. They also could turn down the rate of fluid removal, turn down the ultrafiltration, because we know from a whole bunch of different studies that if once you get above 10 mils per kilo per hour, you are getting into very risky territory. And at 13, there's this mortality curve that just goes whoosh right up.
Yeah.
You know, so if we just would be a little more slow and gentle, you know what the average treatment length is in the U.S. for standard in-center hemo?
3.5 to 4 hours.
3.5 hours is right. That is less than every other industrialized country, and our outcomes are much worse. And I think that's a huge part of the reason.
Yeah, and it just needs to be revamped, and it needs to be reevaluated. I've always, when I took my training, and we gave good dialysis. We didn't turn up the blood flow rate, the VFR, to 450 to 500, which is, to me, in my own opinion, and they do these with
people. You don't
want
to do that either.
But they're doing it. The flow sheets I see are 450, and I'm like, that's speed dialysis.
It's not a good idea.
And catheters. I've even seen catheters, you know. I mean, we need to get back to patient care, and not the faster isn't always the right, you know, indicator. But I do know that I was always told that the quality of life is a true indicator of how well you're being dialyzed.
Do you have an opinion on that? Absolutely, that is so
all these
true.
Numbers,
and,
all
right,
these numbers,
Dr.
really
Scribner,
mean nothing.
I mean, Nancy Spaeth knew Dr. Scribner. I mean, knew him personally. I never got to meet him, but I mean, KT over V, it was a mistake.
Yeah.
It was a mistake from the beginning, I think. I mean, it had a place.
I agree with you.
It had a place in the late 80s and the early 90s where we needed a floor. But the problem is that we forget that it's a floor and we look at it as a target or a goal, you know, or even a ceiling. Oh, wow, look, 95% of people hit the KT over V targets. Isn't that great? Well, no, that's not great. Adequate is not optimal. You know, I mean, an adequate grade in school is, you know, a C or a D. It's not an A. I wouldn't want my taxes to be done by somebody who had adequate training, you know, and I wouldn't want an adequate car repair. I want optimal dialysis if I would need dialysis, you know, not adequate. So anyway, if I were going to change anything in the regulations, it would be to focus them on what really does matter, which is the fluid removal rate and the temperature of that dialysate, because that turns out to be so critical. And, you know, who would have known? I didn't. I really literally just found that out, like, 3 weeks ago.
I'm floored with that. I really am. I'm floored.
Right? Did not know that. I mean, I'd kind of vaguely heard it, and I thought, oh, well, yeah, but who wants cold dialysate? Because have you ever had an IV?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Well, it's an inside chill.
Yes, exactly. If you've ever had a bag of room temperature IV fluid, it is miserable. But we're not talking about a 70-degree dialysate. We're talking about, you know, 95 degrees. It's not that much cooler. And in the studies, it didn't bother people to have it that little bit cooler. So doctors, I think, if I could, I'm still waving my wand. Let's pretend you're a genie and I got three wishes instead. Okay.
Well, that could
wish
be a dangerous story.
It could. I know.
Yeah,
the,
yeah.
You want to wish for three more wishes thing. The biggest change I would make for nephrologists is to change the training to require that they have a chronic dialysis rotation that includes peritoneal dialysis and home hemo. Because what's really shocking, and most people don't know, is that in the U.S., most nephrologists don't get any chronic dialysis training. They only ever see dialysis patients in the ICU when they're fellows. And there's no requirement that they see chronic patients or home patients at all. There's an exam that they have to take to become right? There's an exam to become certified nephrologists. It's called the American Board of Internal Medicine exam, ABIM. That exam has 240 questions. 5% of those are on all dialysis. So somebody could theoretically get a 95% score on that exam and not know any dialysis at all. Now, I doubt that that happens, but we did do a study of nephrologists, and 38% of them said that they felt that at the point where they took that test, they didn't feel like they were really prepared fully to take care of dialysis patients, and most of them never got any additional dialysis training. So to me, that says there's a problem. The good news is there's an answer. The American Board of Internal Medicine now has a new, as of I think a year or two ago, a new chair, executive director, or whatever he is, and he is a doctor who actually is focusing these exams more on clinical care of patients. So, and the American Society of Nephrology has a work group that has taken steps to add some questions into this exam. So there's some movement on that front, which is really good, but, you know, I mean, imagine having an oncologist who didn't know anything about chemotherapy. Not okay, right? Are you still there? Maybe not. Well, in case you're still there, I will tell you my last wish, my magic wand, which is the biggest change consumers could make. And that would be, still there?
Yeah, I'm back. No, it just ended the show. I just had to restart it. Like I said, I missed Carol. So we're on. This is just too interesting. We're going further. I mean, I've learned so much. Carol is the radio host that usually does the show.
Right, and send her my best. I hope that everything goes really well for her.
Well, yeah, she's pretty positive about it, and, you know, people are calling her so she doesn't feel all alone. But if you want to continue, I'm sorry about that. It just doesn't warn you that your show's late, so we're going over our time, and we have no time. We have an hour. We can keep going. I think this is really important for as long as you want to educate us.
Ah, well, yeah, be careful what you wish for, because I could go on for days.
This is something that the patient, and I'm enjoying it. I'm learning quite a bit. So this has been an education for me, and you better believe I will be on your side being educated. I think being a worker, you know, I had a lab background, but it was like a 2-year college course in less than a month. And you're not crying during it, and we were all medical. I mean, I trained with an ICU nurse and ER nurse. It's such a specialty field.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, I worked my way through college as a nursing assistant and then a unit clerk at University Hospital, which was a tertiary care hospital. that was, it was really neat. It was a really neat experience. And patient care is, it's very powerful stuff, and it's very moving, and I burned out. It was, I mean, I would go home and dream about people.
Yes.
I still remember some of those folks, and that was, wow, 30-plus years ago.
Yeah, there's some that I think that's what got me started on this was my patients were my friends. I knew their children, their grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was part of their family. And then, you know, given too much work, that being a worker is a hard job in dialysis. And it's getting worse because, you know, there's no, you have, there's no ratio. I mean, you can put as many, and it's, you know, I have a problem with that. So that is when I took on my little, you know, diatribe, you know. But you are totally right. I think that even physicians need to be trained.
They, some states do have ratios. I think, if I recall correctly, one of the things that Dale did, I think he did this before he died, is in Arizona. I think that they did get, I think they did get ratios passed there. He lived in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Not every state has it.
That way?
Not every state has it. Just a handful.
No. I've always thought, you know, it's federal money, basically. Then why don't we have federal statutes for everybody?
Why don't we have federal money to develop patient education materials?
Yeah, correct. And you know, that
how come we spend $60,000+ a year on each patient, but we can't spend, oh, I don't know, 5 or 10 or 20 per patient on education materials? There's no federal dollars for that.
There ought to start being some. I think that a lot of groups and organizations need to band together and have a voice for the patients. I really do. And I support home hemo, transplants, and education. But I also believe that technicians should have more education before they're thrown on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
With, you know, some kind of training. I mean, you can be a flower arranger in some states, and you have to have a license.
Certification. Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Hairdresser.
Yep. Dog groomer.
Yeah. Yes, true. And I'm like, why don't we have that with life and death? I've never understood that. Why aren't we doing
that
better
for a long
job
time.
Training? Pardon?
I said I've wondered that for a long time.
Oh, I mean, I used to have, well, when I first started, it was 3 patients. Wow, that was, you really got to know, and it was excellent care. Your patients were thriving. It was a happy place to be for all of us. And then all of a sudden you start throwing in extra patients. And I found myself, you have to get a patient on and off within 15 minutes. And if one patient is late, it throws off your whole assembly line. And I remember what really bothered me and it hit me was I had another patient coming on. My other person was having low blood pressure, they just moved the chair away and put another chair there. I mean, it was just like, no one's going to be able to go home on time tonight. We're not paying overtime. And I just, I that has always bothered me, is the ratio and the training.
Yeah, somebody was telling me that she had gotten some plasmapheresis treatment for a transplant. You know, a little transplant glitch just to make sure that things continued to go well. And that the way that she was treated when she went in to get the plasmapheresis was so different than the way that she was treated when she went into the dialysis facility that she just couldn't get over it. It was a completely different atmosphere. You know, it was respectful and it was kind and it was, you know,
right.
And I don't know what kind of clinic she was in. And, you know, there are some great clinics and there are some not so great clinics.
Oh, there are.
But
right.
Yeah, it was... It was really striking for her how different it was.
Well, I've always said they would never treat cancer patients like they treat dialysis patients at a lot of these centers because and the workers, it's just set up for us against them. Do you know what I'm saying? And it's not. We were a team when we had time to give excellent care, but we were all had to have medical backgrounds before they would even consider taking us and through dialysis. So that would be my wand, is technician training.
Mm-hmm.
And to have patients be able to speak out, because I think that as a worker, when I had that extra couple more patients, I went from an excellent worker and really loved my patients to when I get around to it, I'll give it to you.
Right.
So I did not have time to give that extra nurturing either. It's a hard job, and I don't think a lot of patients understand that.
Right.
It's set up us against them instead of a community.
I kind of like this magic wand idea, and maybe that's what you can do on your website, if there's sort of a place for that, is, you know, all right, if you could wave the magic wand, what would you change? It'd be interesting to see what happens.
Well, my trouble, and I have to borrow everybody's wand, Tori. I would be stealing wands, let me tell you. But I do know that there's more people aware now. There's more people that care. You cannot be in medicine and not care. You can't, or do what you do. I'm just amazed. I didn't realize. I knew you were a powerhouse. I've heard your name for years, but I just didn't realize the depth.
Well, remember, we didn't do that all last year. This is many years worth of stuff.
Well, still, I mean, I've been doing this 17 years, Dory. I think that you have a lot to be proud of.
Thank you very much.
And I definitely will put that. I think that we need to educate, and if you need anything from us, let us know. We will support you in any way that we can, whatever that's worth.
Sounds terrific. I will send you those links, and you can share them with crew and send us folks where we talk to all sorts of people.
Yeah, well, I thank you for being on the show a lot. And next week, I'm going to see how Carol feels, and we'll go from there. But we have you ever heard of Dr. Robert Baer? He's a nephrologist.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well,
I'm pretty sure I met him.
Yeah, a wonderful man. He's a nephrologist. He's retired.
Is he from
Canada?
Wrote
a book called, he's living in Canada now, but he was in the United States, from my understanding. Wonderful man. But he wrote a book called Sorrow's Rewards, and he's going to be on March 19th. And
he's terrific. I met him when I was doing something with Network 14 in Texas, and he is terrific, and you will really enjoy having him.
Yeah. So, I'm really excited about that. Next week, we'll probably air another show if Carol's not, a past show if Carol's not better. If she's not feeling that well, which I don't think she will be. But I thank you, Dory, and I hope we talk many more times. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you. I have too. And you have a great night.
Okay, you take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.